Hi, hello. Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea, the self-love podcast for women, though all self-lovers are welcome here. I'm Mary. I write and speak about self-love, and I'm best known for my book, The Gift of Self-Love, and I also host retreats for women. And this is the podcast that will inspire you to love yourself. Real quick, before we dive in, I want to make sure you know about my book, The Gift of Self-Love. It's a workbook to help you build confidence, recognize your worth, and learn to love who you are. It's available anywhere books are sold. Thousands of people have it, love it, and have told me that it has greatly benefited their self-love journey, and I hope it'll do the same for you. And now let's get into the podcast. So Joy, what's been your proverbial cup of tea lately? Something small that's been bringing you joy?
I recently adopted a pair of bonded kittens, and I had a 15-year-old cat that was like my ride or die pass away like 6 months ago. And I told myself I wasn't going to get a cat for a long time. And then I saw these kittens and brought two of them home, and they have just been wonderful, lighting up my life. Amazing.
Where did you find them and what did you name them?
We were just a posting for like my cat got out and had kittens and I have all these kittens. Does anyone want them? And I was like, I'll just go and look. Like, I have to start like the grieving process of warming myself up. I'm going to like not want them. And then I came home with two and I named them Fig and Ollie. And then I have a third cat named Luna. So it's Luna and the Twins, which sounds kind of like a cool band name.
Yeah, it's giving Florence and the Machine, but feline.
Right.
I love that for you. I'm so inspired to join your writing community, and the enrollment is only open twice a year. I would personally love to know more about it.
Yeah, so I run a writing community called Sustenance for poets and essayists who want to fiercely commit to their craft. And it's called Sustenance because it goes back to that idea of creativity as literal survival. And I'm somebody who's experienced a lot of times of hiatus, not been able to write, not been able to even interact with my creative brain. But what has kept me alive is a pulse or a community of other people that are sort of nourishing me when I'm in my own dry season. And that's why Sustenance, like the community will feed you even when you come empty-handed to the space. And then in time, you're able to write again and to feel your own creative brain. But I think a lot of us, myself included, get really stressed that if we don't feel creative 100% of the time, we're not real creatives or writers. And I just think that's why community is so important. So yeah, it's a craft-driven community. I teach a ton in the community. I teach generative sessions. And then we have an amazing guest speaker who comes every month. We have small group accountabilities and groups. We have small core groups. We have essay club every Friday, once a month. And then this year, we're starting to meet across the U.S. in like 7 meetup cities.
So, Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, Phoenix, Arizona. We'll have to add that one. But yeah, it's been really fun. We have an annual retreat. I'm really interested, as we're all such digital nomads now, really translating that into real life experiences. So we do have 7 meetup cities that meet up every quarter. And then we have one annual retreat so we can all learn in real time together.
Mm-hmm. A big fan of retreats. There's nothing like in person because you know totally. It's not AI. Yeah. You said that people get stressed when they come empty handed. I get stressed personally. Like my roadblock to joining this or something like this is, I don't know if it's just capitalist brainwashing, but I feel like it needs to have some kind of like end result. Like I'm not working on a book. I'm not trying to start a Substack. Like what kind of people join this community and how many of those are pursuing writing, I suppose, as a career?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd say we have a mix. There are some people who are like, I just want to invest in my creative interior world. And I really think of it as like the creative architecture of our souls. That's why we write poetry. There's like really no other reason to do it. Like it makes us brighter beings in the world. It affects everything we see and experience and love and know and absorb. So there are lots of people who are like, just the practice of being a creative person in community and in context is enough. And then there are people who are like, I deeply want to have a book in the world. And I want to give a lot. I want to give a year to pursuing that passionately. You can find a mix, truly. Like, the generative sessions are so lovely and warm and connective. And again, it's like that drip drip of keeping yourself plugged in and pulsing so you don't burn out. I didn't write for almost 7 years after my MFA program ended. And I just remember thinking, like, I am so desolately alone in this. And I didn't have a creative community. And it's what reminded me when I started Sustenance, like, that is what people need. They need to just not completely fall away into isolation. There are other people that will keep them connected to their creative brain, even if they're actively not writing a book, right?
Absolutely. Well, I don't have any smooth segue, but I don't know. Would you say you're in your villain era?
Yeah. If you want to say that, I'll take it.
Okay. Well, I mean that as the highest of compliments, because you recently wrote about your relationship to this idea of goodness, specifically women constantly trying to be good. Can you expound on that? Or, like, what does that mean to you?
Yeah. So I was raised in a very evangelical context. And so, you know, when you come out of literal purity culture, but also a religion that's very focused on the don'ts and the things that you're not supposed to do, not just being framed as mistakes, but as literal sins, I think you get a real complex about how you move in the world. And then I've just discovered, as somebody now with, like, kind of unexpected visibility, there's this added pressure to be, like, a really pure moral person. And I think we all want to be that, but then it gets really exhausting when everyone has a different definition of what that is. And so I become really fascinated by this idea of what is that, and how did I, like, basically escape the purity culture of my very restrictive upbringing to sort of find myself in a contemporary progressive left zone version of it. And so I've been trying to figure out what that means for me as I, like, unpack what my own sense of integrity is among this, like, it feels like a million different people always weighing in about what a woman should do, especially a woman online. And I was just talking to a friend last night, and she was like, I'm thinking about building an Instagram following. Like, do you think it's worth it? And she said, I just have been really anxious that people won't think I'm, like, a moral person if they disagree with me. And I was like, I hear women say that all the time. And I don't always hear men express that same kind of anxiety about always having to get it right. So I become really fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm. I have personal complicated feelings about this, because the idea of goodness and morality just suffocates me as a woman, also grew up in intense religion, et cetera, et cetera. So I couldn't agree more with you. And when I think about, like, okay, well, men are never expected to perform goodness in this way, and they never get canceled for telling a paparazzi off, you know, if you're, like, a female celebrity, as an example. And then I have this follow-up thought where I'm like, should we try to do away with this idea of goodness to give ourselves the same permission that men have historically gotten? Or would it be a better use of time, energy, and attention to hold men to a higher standard to that goodness?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think, I don't really know, but I'm mostly interested in the idea of efficiency. And that is, like, what truly drives, like, human behavior to change? We all want to, like, become the healthiest versions of ourselves. We all want men to also have, like, a stakehold in the the moral implications of their actions in the world, as we're all, like, struggling against a really difficult future right now. So I think it's more like, for me, it's like, how do we actually see that, like, action or change happens? And it's just because you want to suffer less. I think that's the bottom line, is that, like, I get up early in the morning and I read my book and I commit to my creative practice because I want to suffer less. It doesn't really make me, like, if we do it only for being, like, trying to reach some moral level of superiority, we only get in these shame-based traps. So I'm not really interested in shaming anyone for their decisions, but I am interested in the idea that when we're all called to our higher selves, we suffer individually less and we suffer collectively less. So I kind of dodged your question, but I think there's an answer in there of like, how do we think about collective and individual suffer lessening? It's by like orienting ourselves towards one another and like committing to humanity in a really serious way.
Mm-hmm. And you recently wrote about this and it got quite the press. You called it, the phrase used is tiny evils. Could you tell us more about tiny evils? And I especially like how it felt like the reverse of like guilty pleasures.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm kind of fascinated by this question. I love to ask it at dinner parties or on dates. And it's like, what is your tiny evil? And a tiny evil is such a fun concept to me because it's like this little thing that you do that you secretly enjoy because you're being just like a tiny bit bad. And what's been fascinating about these tiny evils is everyone has different experiences of them. And you also, you learn about a lot about someone's sense of ethicality in any way they're neurotic. And also, so there's a big difference between how men and women answer this question. So for example, a tiny evil, I've heard so many of them now and I love all of them, but like my tiny evil is that sometimes I go or walk in a grocery store and in the bottom of a bag, like something really crunchy, like dried blueberries, I'll crush one or two blueberries and then I'll leave the store without paying for it. I think as somebody who's struggled so hard with perfectionism and purity, there's this kind of like immense release in like doing something just like slightly bad, but not inherently harmful. I have a friend who will always purposely give directions, wrong directions to men. I have another friend who in the Hobby Lobby will like reorient the messages, like the little letters to say like really dirty things. And I love that. So it's like really fascinating. So that's like one area of the fascination with this idea of tiny evils. But I'm also like very interested in how some people get really stressed by this idea of like, why would anyone want to do any modicum of harm? And I think it's sort of the wrong question because for me, I'm like, well, we all do. We all do harm all the time. We're all human. And like, I personally would never give the wrong directions to anyone, man or woman. But I'm obsessed with knowing that my friend does this and it endears me to her. And I feel closer to her because I understand her to be deeply human. And that's the beauty of the question for me. But like men really struggle, I've found, with this question. And they get very often, like they get very stuck on the literalness of it. And I don't know if it's because they can't see the little things or they've had less of a mantle of having to always get it right and be good, that maybe they don't pleasure in the same tiny evils in the way that women societally maybe react against their own conditioning. Does that make sense?
Kind of. What my brain is hearing is that men haven't been held to such extreme standards of goodness. So it's not as hard for them to like adhere to them because it's not like a suffocating blanket of shame. Whereas women like these tiny acts of rebellion because it's our only source of like feeling liberated.
Yeah, I think so. And I think like men don't even identify their tiny evils as such. Like they don't see it as a tiny evil. It doesn't enter their language.
They're just existing. I mean, Elise Lewin, she wrote this book called On Our Best Behavior, The Price Women Pay to Be Good. She was on this podcast exactly a year ago. And it's exactly that, that men are committing tiny evils all the time. But like you said, they get hung up in the language. So maybe they would understand it more if they're like, oh, it's more funny or just existing or like something that is a lot less serious maybe to them because it's not, you know, it's not as loaded.
Totally. And I think that they don't internalize it in the same way. Like my tiny evils is like, sometimes I don't wash out the little kitten can of wet food. And sometimes I put it in the trash because it's got really sharp edges. And I terrorize myself at night imagining my kittens getting into the recycling bin and licking the edges. And so like, for a while when they were really young, I was like, I threw out a couple cans and then was like so filled with like guilt over that choice because I hadn't recycled. And I just noticed that men are very much more comfortable to be like, well, I just did what I had to do. I made a choice because I was prioritizing this other thing where I'm holding like, I'm worried about my kittens cutting their tongues on the cans and I'm worried about saving the planet via recycling. And I just noticed that like, men potentially are just not tortured in that same way, which is interesting to me. Where they're like, well, you just made a choice. You made a choice. You didn't want, you know, and I'm interested in that, but I'm also sort of annoyed by it because I also see men, I would like them, to your point earlier, to be a little more tortured about ethics at times.
That's a perfect example. And I noticed that when I went through your comments under that essay, most women, when they described their tiny evil, it was a Robin Hood-esque action on their part. And I was thinking of my tiny evil. And the only thing I could come up with on the spot is I take all the tampons from my big fancy gym and I make little packets for like the homeless. And then I'm like, yeah, but I also like take those tampons for myself too, like not to paint myself as the saint. And I noticed your comments are flooded with that. I especially love, did you see that one that's like, it boosted up to the top on my feed where this woman takes all the like expensive grocery goods and puts them in the charity box at the grocery store because she's sick of grocery stores for taking credit for their charitable contributions when us consumers are actually paying to donate said groceries into those bins. And then she just plays dumb if anybody ever says anything like, oh, I thought it was just the donate box for your store. I loved that one. That was such a good one. But yeah, it is interesting to see that most of our tiny evils have to still have some good in them.
I know. That actually drove me nuts because I was like, these are not actually tiny evils. That's just resistance. That's just activism, you know? It was funny to me the way that women had to also make their tiny evils some charitable act that helped other people. And it reminds me of like when I lead group retreats of women, like one of the opening questions is I say, well, I want to hear a brag about yourself. And women will be like, well, I am just so loving and I take care of everyone around me. And I'm like, do it again. I want to hear something about you that's just a full-on phenomenal brag. Like, get a little conceited, get a little vain. I don't want to hear how you know, are sacrificial. That's very beautiful. And I allow women to tell me that on retreats. But I felt similarly to the tiny evils comments where it was like, I am still secretly performing my goodness. And there is nothing wrong. I think it's very beautiful to buck a really ugly capitalistic system by, you know, putting groceries in the donate bin. But I also don't want us to feel that we can't fully embrace our humanity, that we couldn't actually say, yeah, sometimes I pee in the pool, you know? And there's nothing good about it. It doesn't help anyone, and that's okay. And it's like, I got so much controversy about that. And it was all from women. They were so angry with me. I mean, people told me I was causing food insecurity by crushing blueberries at the bottom of bags. People said that I was encouraging evil in a world of great harm. Why would I be encouraging more tiny harms? That actually isn't my intent with the piece. And it got picked up by Glamour UK. And that was really fun. But I was realizing like, oh, this is controversial because women can't imagine being fully comfortable with their own flawed humanity. And I'm actually not endorsing, immorality. I'm actually suggesting that we all do these things. And your tiny evil might be too far on my scale and my tiny evil might be too far on yours. But I'm interested in the authenticity of women talking about the ways that they not only buck the system, but they also live with their own imperfections and they don't actively try to change them.
Hey, self-lover, sorry to interrupt, but do you have my self-love playlist? There's over 300, if not 400 songs on it that are so fun and uplifting and empowering, and I think will really be perfect for when you're getting ready, trying to hype yourself up, dealing with a bad body image day, or anytime you just want a little boost of self-love, these tracks will do it for you. So head to maryscupoftea.com/playlist to get it and know that I am dancing and jamming with you from afar. Cheers. I think it's interesting that the pushback you got came from fellow women, of course. Elise Lewin also talked about this, like women policing each other. A lot of the times this price we pay to be good is at the hands of fellow women. And at the end of the day, we're all complicit in our own ways. And so, like you say, we all cause harm. Like we're all consuming, we're ordering from Amazon, we're driving, not carpooling because we don't want to drive with that person you know, in our car. We do so many things, but why is it so hard for us to kind of own it? And it goes back to that performance piece, right?
Yeah. Like, I just want women to fess up. Like, yeah. I just want them to be honest. And it's fascinating, in a group of women sitting around a table doing this, everyone will have one. And you will see the intimacy just expand in that room with women sharing sometimes really maniacal little things that they do. But online, it's that visibility thing where we again get locked into the, I have to perform, I have to call out. It's usually white women who are the most aggressive about it. And that's just interesting to me. So the whole thing was kind of a fascinating experience. Somebody was like, you know, why not do tiny goods? And I said, you know what, Jessica? I do lots of tiny goods all the time. But the title of this essay is not tiny goods. It's tiny evils. So I'm kind of fascinated by it. I think, though, the more interesting context around that essay is the reaction to the essay. So I think there is a second essay in store about how uncomfortable we are publicly admitting the ways that we subvert.
Absolutely. I can't wait to read that. Can't wait. And what a great conversation starter for a group of girlfriends or as a dating experiment, like you said, with whatever gender, and just seeing how people answer it and also what intimacy it creates. I want to make sure I heard you correctly. You said something like, I want women to just confess. Was that the word used?
Sort of fess up to their own imperfections. Yeah.
Okay. It's funny you said that, because I was thinking about your writing style and why I've loved it so much over the years. I think I got your book when it first came out. Was that 2023?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it's been about 2.5 years. And what I love so much about it is that there's this conviction to it. Like, you know what, Jessica? That is not what this essay is about. And it does almost read like a confession. Your poetry almost reads like a confession, but without that blanket of shame that you mentioned earlier, which is what in turn makes it so liberating. So I'd love to hear like what writing does for you, why you see it as sustenance.
Yeah, I think I've always felt that, and I become so much more convinced of it as we like barrel towards this very unknown future, which is full of like AI and scary technological developments that are driving our isolation and our alienation from each other. I see creativity as pure survival. I just see it as a way to stay alive. I think it's so intrinsic to our humanity that we just can't give it up. We can't outsource our creative sovereignty to anything other than ourselves. And so for me, the book and writing the book, I mean, that idea of survival goes back to my childhood. I grew up overseas where I didn't speak the language. And so, you know, my parents would take us to church services, and it was always, the sermons were always like 4 to 5 hours long in the whole service. And I couldn't speak the language, so I couldn't understand it. And that is when I started writing. I started writing spy novels during these long sermons that I didn't understand, which is this like kind of beautiful subversive thing too. But I love that that was always a creative instinct saying, this is how we stay alive. And that has carried me through every hard season. I mean, I wrote the book in COVID when I was totally cut off from everybody else and living alone. I was putting these poems in the world. So I think this idea of creativity as survival feels really true and increasingly urgent.
A lot of times people see their art as trivial, which I'm sure is something you have to battle against as just somebody who exists on the internet talking about these topics. Do you get that a lot? Or do you think people really see the value of creativity and how it is a tool for survival?
I think people do when they experience it, but I think we experience creativity as pleasure and not as a necessity. You know, There's that amazing quote, poetry is not a luxury, right? And I think that there's that idea of like, this is actually your creative brain, your creative mind is the best gift, the best investment you will ever make in yourself. I did like a meditation last night with a group of women where we imagined getting on a hot air balloon and flying into the future 40 years and meeting our older selves and seeing what wisdom that older self had for us. Mm-hmm. And like going to the cottage door wherever you live and walking in and asking that person like, what is it that I need to know now? And that for me is like an 80-year-old woman. And she, you know, when I got to her cottage door, she was like, you have to invest in your creative work. And like this time is the time to really nurture that, to really nourish that. And I think that gets really lost. So I'm trying to do, even personally, I'm trying to do more of that because it's so hard when you're building a business and doing a million other things to let that go.
Yeah. There's so many different definitions of creativity. I'm wondering what you see creativity as, because I think somebody listening to this might be like, well, of course she has the right to pursue her creative work because it gives her a platform and a book and it's valuable to others. You know, there's actually like I know you're trying to be like amoral about the tiny evils, but there is a sense of empowerment in that, right? There's like goodness. What kind of like counts, I guess, is creativity? Like what else can be a creative pursuit?
Totally. I think it's like for me, and it feels very tied to, I've recently gotten into very erotic dance, and that feels like I'm stretching into this, oh, totally different creative modality that isn't writing on the page, but this kind of different language that's translated in the body. But I think it's just the turning towards the sovereign self. It's really any act that expresses the most truest sovereign piece of ourselves. So that might be erotic dance or any form of dance. That might be writing or poetry or singing or art. But I think it's really tough for us because we live in such a consumptive capitalist world that we have to productize and make and then have readerships and selling our art and make money off of it and then be able to build livelihoods. And I know it's really hard for me as someone who now has a platform, who has a whole business because of her art, who has a best-selling book. Like those are all beautiful things, but I will not say they have not made me happier or a better artist and writer to get them, which is the real paradox of any time we make our art or our writing hold the burden of our creative livelihoods. You know, people tell me all the time, if I just had a readership, I'd write more. And I'm like, you know, what's the biggest threat to my second book is my readership and my constant internalization of what everybody wants from me next. So I don't know. I think it's one of those things that if you can orient your life towards it in a way that it doesn't have to bear the pressure of your entire livelihood, you'll be better off.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a catch-22 though, because I think the dream is to do what you love and you never have to work a day in your life. But I think my sister, surprisingly, she's only 17 and she's an extraordinary artist, a painter, an oil painter, and she's about to go off to college next year and is very torn about what to pursue because obviously art has been validated for her on so many levels. She's been in galleries, she's been in programs, she's, you know, gets all sorts of praise and accolades for it. But I think deep down inside, she knows that it would be really hard to have the pressure of like trying to get paid for it. And of course, the AI thing is very present in her mind too. And she's only 17. So it's hard for me as a big sister to kind of navigate her in the right direction because I was very much raised with do what you love, like pursue your passion and the money will come. And like, this is your passion, like do it. But then I also, I don't know, I'm thinking of my ex's friend acquaintance who is a dentist like by trade. And he does that so he can make enough money to have a 4-day weekend and ski every single weekend, you know? And I think that's cool too. Like, does he have to become a ski instructor? No, like it's okay to like split your brain so that you're not completely exhausted and consumed by your own creative pursuit and how people perceive it.
Yeah, you know, my background was in brand before I became a full-time writer and entrepreneur. And I worked at an agency and there was a designer who worked with me. And, you know, at that time, I was so excited to be like making money in corporate America. I was like trying to get promoted. I was trying to climb the ladder as fast as I could. And he was going the absolute opposite direction. He'd been there for many years and he refused to be given any promotions because he said, if they promote me, I will have to stay here after hours. And all he wanted to do at 5 o'clock was clock out, go home and play in his punk band and make his weird alien art. And he just loved that. And so I've always admired and thought about him because it's like, that is also such a worthy route to take. I think there's a pipe dream a little bit that you have to be a smash success and make your art bear the brunt of all your bills and somehow execute your creative vision. And I think what scares me about that route is it makes us less willing to take risks in our own art, because if you're making it pay the bills, then, you know, it's really hard to do the thing that scares you a little bit. And my friend recently told me, Joy, for your next book, I think you should aim for a 2.5 Goodreads review. Like, you should aim for something really low and polarizing, you know? And it's like, I think that there's a real brilliance to that, because if we're not scaring ourselves, if we're not taking the risks that we want to, we will simply burn out as artists. So I also think, you know, I'm not saying you can't make a livelihood of your creative work, but you better be dedicated ferociously to your own creative mind, to your own creative evolution. And you better be ready to roll some dice to satisfy your own creative hunger, if that makes sense. Because if you live by other people's creative appetites, you'll just starve.
Wow. Yeah, that is such a mindset shift to be like, I think you should aim for a 2.5 score on Goodreads. It just makes me think of so many things. My voice coach, for example, always tells us to do 60 to 80. It depends on what the exercise is. But she says, do 60% of what you're capable of. Kind of like lowering the stakes so dramatically. I mean, in your case, your friend actually kind of heightened the stakes in a reverse psychology kind of way. But yeah, it is such a barrier to start making money from your work. And I'm not trying to say this as a humble brag, but there's so much. I have so many videos made. I have so many like little captions, like little silly things that I'd wanted to post. But I am so grateful and fortunate that I was able to get some of the biggest dream brand deals of my life in the last quarter. And I'm under a contract where I can't be a part of like any controversy or else they could not pay. And with the payment terms being like net 90, for example, and the work's already been delivered and everything, it's just such a risk. And that's just one small example. And I finally sat down to write after taking a huge hiatus since my second book. And a piece just poured out of me and I titled it, Why Dogs Are Better Than Dads. And of course I didn't publish that, you know? That would get me so much hate. And aside from like the stakes of the brand deals, there's a part of me that's like, maybe I should just protect my peace. Like maybe this is just writing for me and not for the internet. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thank you for, thank you just for everything you do. Thank you.
Well, I have lots of thoughts about that. My heart breaks a little bit for you on the brand deal front, because it's really real and it's really valid that you feel that way. But man, I think it's so tough. As someone who's also visible online, this fear, this terror of being canceled makes so many creative decisions for me. And no one truly is better. Not the work that I am not producing, not my students, not my writers. But I think it does kind of cripple us and make us afraid to take real creative risks in the pursuit of what is true. Mm-hmm. And so then I think it's why I'm obsessed with Tiny Evils, is because then we perform our goodness over and over and over without ever seeing ourselves fully for what we are. Beautiful, imperfect, flawed people, always capable of evolution. Right. And so, you know, for me, I've been working with my own writing coach. You know, it's like every coach should have a coach, but I've been writing with my own writing coach. And she's been having me do this terrifying and fascinating assignment where I write, you should hate me because, and I fill in that blank. And it's just this list of why I think people could or should hate me. You should hate me because sometimes
you pee in the pool.
Right. You should hate me because I crush blueberries in the store. You should hate me because sometimes I toss a can in the trash. You should hate me because, you know, and then it got really emotional. You should hate me because the only man I've loved this year left me. You should hate me because, you know, just this kind of like beautiful reflection. And then it was so interesting at the end of writing all the reasons that people could or would or possibly could hate me. At the end of that was some real opportunity for empathy for myself, but I couldn't get there with any actually like therapeutic lens. Like, I should love myself because, like,
yeah, bullshit.
Yeah, bullshit. Fuck that. I can't deal. Yeah. But I have nightmares all the time about being canceled, and the nightmares have gotten intensely better after doing that. But I talk a lot about, like, there's great stuff in there, and how can I get to that? That interesting, true human condition place when we're so punished all the time for being honest. So mm-hmm. that's, I think, the great struggle of visibility. And the other is exactly what you're talking about of, like, there's also this dopamine of wanting to show and put my work all the time in the world. So the, like, great lesson of my second book is not putting it anywhere and writing things as if I had no audience. I mean, I'm putting things in this document about why you should hate me that I, like, would die if anyone got to read. But then I'm like, ooh, I just uncovered some fascinating territory that I really want to turn someday into an essay. But it's like training ourselves as writers to not pursue the quick dopamine hit that's going to perform the same recycled bullshit that everybody always sees online, but also gets to access something more interesting and more true. And that takes time, and that takes courage, and that takes risk. So I'm still on that journey, but I'm right there with you and, like, constantly worried about how something will be received.
Mm. And I love writing because it teaches you how to think. So these writing exercises that your coach gives you and what we're talking about on the podcast for our listeners, like, somebody doesn't have to be a writer trying to publish a book of poems or essays. It is more about the thought exercise, like the thought experiment. And the advice you give to writers, you did, like, a carousel post sharing one piece which said, write what you parentheses wish you didn't know. Yeah. And oh my God, I love this so much because it reminds me of, what was that viral TikTok that was like, say the weird thing? Or on a more serious spiritual note, Tara Brach always asks, what are you unwilling to feel? Like, that'll get you to the root of your humanity and experiencing more of life. So you wrote, we've all heard the advice, write what you know, but I dare you to write what you wish you didn't know. Your weird insecurities, your loneliness, the fact that your dog isn't fully housebroken, or your toddler always cries, or you're a poet with writer's block, catalog all the ways you're human and stop trying to be a hero. The ripple effect that you have on people, I don't know if you know this or if I mentioned when I pitched to you, but Victoria Hutchins, she also came out with a poetry book this year. She talked about you for a good chunk of our conversation on this podcast earlier this year. Like, she literally talked about you as giving her the courage to write and release her poetry book. I don't have a question. I just want you to know that.
Well, thank you for telling me. That's so meaningful. And if Victoria ever listens to this, hi, Victoria. Congrats on her beautiful book that came out earlier. I think it's just, I'm really interested in shame because it ran the show through so much of my childhood. And I think one reason I write in the way that I do is because I'm literally trying to exercise shame from my body. And I'm trying to think through why I feel shame. And it's almost like if I tell you first, and I already tell you that I'm tortured or worried or scared about this thing, then I get to, like, own it. I get to hold it. And it may be you get to say the thing that you're terrified to say too, which I think is the ripple effect of all poetry. You know, that don't be a hero of your own work is something that the poet Ellen Bass taught me, which was just like, if you are the hero consistently of your own poems, you probably have some really bad poems on your hands. And you probably have some really untrue poems, because the reality is the human condition is so freaking messy. And I think women especially get stuck in their shame spirals. And it's this, you know, I think about Miranda July. She's one of my heroes all the time. And I'm just like, man, she writes in a way that I'm just like, there is no fear. She's a little bit older than I am. And I'm like, okay, maybe when I get my late 40s in 10 years, I'm going to, like, have no fucks to give. I hope so, because that's the kind of writing I'm most interested in. And what I tell writers is, again, you've got to really cultivate that appetite. You can't be writing for clickability. You can't be writing for likes. You can't really even be writing to get a platform unless you're a copywriter, which is great. Mm-hmm. But you can choose. You want to be a poet or a copywriter. And I'm actually not, there's actually no judgment between those two things. There's just a simple definition. And if you mm-hmm. want to be a poet, if you want to be a creative writer, you have to have like this ferocious, insatiable appetite to evolve. And the only way you evolve is to take some really big risks.
Mm-hmm. I so badly wanted to ask you about erotic dance to end on a sexy note, but then my brain is also like wanting to know what poem in Instructions for Traveling West, which one has been, I guess, from that deepest part of your soul that you talk about. I'm assuming all of them are from that general area. One of the pieces of advice you give too is like right from the gut. Is that what you say? Mm-hmm. Right from
right.
the belly?
Yeah, right yeah. from the belly.
So I guess I'm assuming that mostly all of them are coming from that area of your midsection. But is there one that just like really means a lot to you?
I mean, they all definitely feel like they're trying to orbit or inhabit that very sovereign, true place. But I think the one that comes immediately to mind is Wood Frog, which I remember wrote at a conference, writing conference with Ada Limon. And I got to read it to her in a workshop. And she said, that's not a poem. That's like a survival cry, a battle cry, a war cry. And I remember being like, yeah. Yeah, that's what it is. So that one comes immediately to mind.
Do you have it handy? Would it be possible to ask you to read it as like a closing parting gift?
Totally.
And we'll have to do a part two to talk about sexy dance.
Always, always down to talk about erotic dance and the way that it changes your entire experience of being alive. This is called Wood Frog. The day I found out my partner had relapsed, I was in California. The sky so blue, it howled. I'd just eaten a lemon strudel and put honey in my tea, stacking pleasure upon pleasure. That morning, we'd sent each other love texts, the sexy kind that make other people blush. Here's life. One day you're planning a wedding and the next you're packing a suitcase and gambling how far half a tank can take you. You're stopping off at bars to flirt with men in tall boots and stupid haircuts. You're shifting sideways on the sidewalk to step over a pile of ants, wishing just once some god would decide not to squash you. You're writing poems and drinking whiskey and bleeding all over the driver's seat as you miscarry your little dream. Is there a way to love and not die? I'm not sure, but the Alaskan wood frog freezes solid in winter only to blast back in spring. Give me that story, the one where her little toad heart, after months of chill, switches back on. Tell me again how she quivers and thumps and shudders awake. Again, how she thaws and opens and outcroaks her summer song.
Well, that was the most beautiful battle cry. I vividly remember where and when I was when I read that, because I've also gone through that exact experience nearly to a T. And I just want to personally thank you. I had no idea that that was the one you'd select to read. So I'm very touched and I feel really connected to you. And I hope our paths cross again.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me on. It was such a treat to chat with you.
If you're enjoying our self-love podcast, please take a moment to leave a comment or a review letting me know what your biggest takeaway was. As somebody who works mostly behind the scenes on this podcast, I love hearing from you and it just keeps me connected to the purpose, which is always to spread the gift of self-love.